Good evening. Reading from Billy Graham's autobiography, entitled Just As I Am, about one of his first times preaching. "No," he answered, "Billy is going to preach." I was stunned. My repertoire at that time consisted of about four borrowed sermons, which I had adapted and practiced, but never preached. This would be different from the old Fellowship Club meetings in Charlotte. There I just got up and let them have it. But in a strange church, a Baptist one at that, what would I do? When I told Mr. Underwood that I had never preached a formal sermon in front of a church audience, he and Dean Minder both laughed. "We'll pray for you," said Mr. Underwood, and God will help you. "All right," I agreed, rather hesitantly. What else could I say to the dean of my school? But I was so frightened that I spent the entire night studying and praying instead of sleeping. I did the same most of the next day, practicing aloud. By evening, I felt confident that any one of my sermons should be good for at least 20 or 30 minutes. The meeting room was small, with a pot-bellied iron stove near the front to take the chill off the cold, windy night. The song leader, who chewed tobacco, had to go to the back door every so often to spit it out. He could have just done it in the stove as conveniently. The congregation of about 40 included ranchers and cowboys in overalls and their women in cotton wash dresses. When the moment came to walk to the pulpit in the tiny Bostwick Baptist Church, my knees shook and perspiration glistened on my hands. I launched into sermon number one. It seemed to be over almost as soon as I got started, so I added number two, and number three, and eventually number four. Then I sat down. 8 minutes. That was all it took to preach all four of my sermons. Was this the stuff of which those marvelous preachers at Florida Bible Institute were made of? Believe it or not, though, when I got back to campus, I felt that I had grown spiritually through the experience. But at the same time, I was concerned. I could not get away from a nagging feeling in my heart that I was being called by God to preach the gospel. I did not welcome that call. Whatever glimmer of talent Dr. Minder might have thought he saw in me was certainly raw, spelled with a capital R. I practiced for when the time would come again to preach in public. My roommate, Woodrow Flynn, was a great sermonizer and would preach his outlines to me in our cold room in front of the little stove. I use outlines borrowed from the great published preachers like Dr. Lee Scarborough. I would paddle a canoe across the Hillsborough, which is a river, to a little island where I could address all creatures, great and small, from alligators to birds. If they would not stop to listen, there was always a congregation of cypress stumps that could neither slither nor fly away. The loudest of my preaching was in direct proportion to their unresponsiveness, so the trees got my voice at full blast. Once some fishermen wandered within earshot, paused in amazement at this bellowing beanpole of a boy who seemed to rise from the river. Too often, a few of my fellow students would line the opposite bank at my return to cheer me on with comments like, "Well, how many converts did you get today, Billy?" One day, Dr. Watson was walking down a corridor of the men's residence building when he overheard a similar practice session. Drawn toward the open door of my room, he looked in to see me shouting a sermon at his four-year-old son, Bobby, whom I'd perched on top of the high antique dresser, perhaps to prevent his escape. So that was the beginning of Billy Graham's career, his ministry, and of course he went a lot further than this point. Tonight's topic is on Billy Graham, and I'm sure many of you have heard of him. But I think it'll be a good exploration of his life and his ministry. There is a lot to be said about this man. I could probably give several topics about him, but I'll try to keep it to one. Tonight I will be focusing on his life story and highlighting lessons that we can learn from his life. I hope this is informative and inspirational for all of you. This topic was given about a half a year ago at Cedar Crest, and so you're getting a little bit of a rerun with a couple additions and subtractions. In my studying, I was kind of blown away by what this man did and what he accomplished in his life. It's quite remarkable. Of course, we know the name Billy Graham, but I don't know how much we know about the rest of his life. He is undoubtedly one of the most influential Christian evangelists of the 20th century, arguably one of the most recognized and powerful men of the last 100 years. As you'll see, his influence and power were worldwide over decades of preaching and ministry. So, let's start off with a couple questions. Who here has seen Billy Graham preach in person? Has anybody? One, two, three, I think. And who would have read a book by Billy Graham, read an article, something like that? Quite a few people. So our lives have been impacted, at least in a small way, by Billy Graham. My sources for tonight are his autobiography, Just As I Am. It was written in 2007. There's a Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. They have a website with a lot of history on that. Christianity Today, Graham, A Day in Billy's Life, which is a book. Also a book, Billy Graham, Candid Conversations with a Public Man. So let's start at kind of the beginning of Billy's life. He was born November 7, 1918. He was born William Franklin Graham Jr. in the downstairs bedroom of a farmhouse near Charlotte, North Carolina. He was of Scots-Irish descent and was the eldest of four children. Graham was raised on a dairy farm with his two younger sisters, Catherine and Jean, and a younger brother named Melvin. The farm was actually quite large for those days. They had about 300 acres, about 400 milk customers that would come to their farm. He grew up with a dairy farm schedule, early in the morning and then milking the cows in the evening again. They milked about 20 cows by hand. He had a fun, pretty normal childhood. He was known for his large appetite. His sister remembers him coming in the back door, grabbing a ripe tomato and just chowing down on this tomato. They lived a quiet but busy life. They always had time for baseball. The family would take yearly trips and then occasionally would go to town for the evening. Their family wasn't wealthy, but they managed what they had well. He was raised by his parents in the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. He later became a Southern Baptist, but he was raised in the Reformed Presbyterian Church. The Graham family was at church every time the doors opened, and prayer was a part of their daily life. From his book, when they read the family Bible in our home, they were not simply going through a pious ritual. Mother told us that they had established a family altar with daily Bible readings the very first day they were married. They accepted the book as the very word of God, seeking and getting heavenly help to keep their family together. Every time my mother prayed with one of us, and every time my parents prayed for their sons and daughters, they were declaring their dependence on God for the wisdom and strength and courage to stay in control of life, no matter what circumstances might bring. Beyond that, they prayed for their children that they might come into the kingdom of God. Graham attended the Sharon Grammar School. He has started to read books from an early age and loved to read the novels for boys, especially Tarzan and Robin Hood. Like Tarzan, he would hang on the trees and give the popular Tarzan yell, scaring horses and drivers. His father joked that the yelling was his first practice at being a minister. Billy wasn't a natural scholar. He enjoyed school, but he would often get lower grades. He loved to read, and he loved to read what he wanted to read. His sister Jean often remembers Billy sitting cross-legged, reading a book, biting his fingernails, and just letting the world go by. According to his autobiography, Graham was converted in 1934 at age 16. One of the farmhands convinced him that he should go to see Mordecai Ham, who was a popular evangelist of that era. He was in town, and they were doing crusades. They'd do crusades for weeks at a time during those days. Graham went night after night. Billy and his buddy, Grady, felt kind of uncomfortable sitting in the audience because Mordecai Ham had this way of making you feel very uncomfortable. So they decided that they're going to join the choir because they could sit behind him. So they sat in the choir. None of them could sing. They'd either mouth the words or hide behind their hymn books, but they felt a little more comfortable behind him. Fortunately, Billy responded to that call, and he went up one night and gave his life to Christ. Although that conversion experience wasn't extremely emotional, it was an intellectual experience for him. And from that time on, he was committed to Christ. The next several years were filled with farm life, high school, and dating girls. He continued to grow in his faith and had an incredible thirst for spiritual teaching. He graduated high school in 1936. After high school, he worked for several years at the Fuller Brush Company, which was, he would travel around from town to town in the Carolinas trying to sell these brushes. Perhaps this gave him an early advantage at public speaking. Around age 20, Billy began to feel the call to become an evangelist. Graham attended Bob Jones College, which is located at Cleveland, Tennessee. Although this was a good college, it was extremely rigid, and he racked up some demerits and didn't like the structure. So he transferred over to Florida Bible Institute in 1937, and that's where this opening story occurred. In his autobiography, Graham relates the night he felt the call to ministry. "But did I want to preach for a lifetime? I asked myself that question for the umpteenth time on one of my nighttime walks around the golf course. The inner irresistible urge would not subside. Finally, one night, I got down on my knees at the edge of one of the greens. Then I prostrated myself on the dewy turf. 'Oh God,' I sobbed, 'if you want me to serve you, I will.' The moonlight, the moss, the breeze, the green, the golf course, all the surroundings stayed the same. No sign in the heavens, no voice from up above. But in my spirit, I knew I had been called to the ministry, and I knew my answer was yes. From that night in 1938, my purpose and objectives in life were set. I knew that I would be a preacher of the gospel. I did not know how or when, however." Billy Graham quotes, "I read Ephesians again and again, where it mentions the Lord gave some to be evangelists and some to be pastors. God did not want me to just be a pastor. It was time to take up what God called me to do, which was to be an evangelist." In the same time period, Billy also began feeling like he should be baptized by immersion, which was done at a nearby lake in 1938. Shortly afterwards, Graham was ordained a minister by a handful of Southern Baptist pastors. He became a Southern Baptist minister in the St. John's River Association. Thus began Billy's preaching career. He began seeking out opportunities to preach. He began doing revival meetings in remote churches throughout Florida. He also went to the Tampa area hospitals, praying for the sick and for the dying. From his book, "And I preached and practiced. Every Saturday I went into the empty sanctuary and rehearsed aloud the sermon that I was going to be preaching the next day. Sometimes I had an audience of one, the janitor, who seemed to feel quite free to make suggestions." Billy invested huge amounts of time and energy into his ministry. He finished up his schooling in Florida in 1940. His time there closed with kind of a dark cloud. One of the main faculty members there was accused of moral indiscretions. They don't think that it was true, but it made a very strong impression on Billy Graham and his future ministry. He went to Wheaton College after this. It's located close to Chicago. He graduated 3 years later with a degree in anthropology, which is the study of cultures and societies. He met his wife at Wheaton College. Her name was Ruth Bell. She was raised in China by a medical family that was doing mission work there. Her father was a doctor. Billy fell in love at first sight. Their first date was to go to the Messiah around Christmas time. She did not know him at all, and he was nervous as could be. She prayed that if God would want them to be together, she would be honored to share his life. Their courtship was a long one. She was determined to be a missionary in Tibet. He felt a very strong calling to be an evangelist. After several proposals, she finally wrote him a letter and said yes. From his book, "That night I got up to the pulpit and preached. When I finished and sat down, the pastor turned to me. 'Do you know what you just said?' he asked. I said, 'No.' 'Well, I'm not sure the people did either.'" So apparently he was pretty excited about this. They were married in 1943 in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina. They had a strong love relationship. Billy talks about there being three of them: God, Ruth, and himself. People have often noted that if there was no Ruth Graham, there would be no Billy Graham. Billy and Ruth pastored a small church in Illinois for a year or two. After that point, he switched and became very active in the Youth for Christ crusades. These were happening across America, and they also did some of these in Europe. In the late 40s, he was elected interim president of Northwestern College. He enjoyed managing the school, but his busy schedule made keeping up with the school demands very difficult. He also noted an increased acceptance and need for evangelism in America, so he resigned this position in 1952. During a crusade in Modesto, California, Billy and his team made a very remarkable agreement. Traveling evangelists have been getting a bad name for several reasons. Billy asked each member of the team to go to their rooms for 1 hour and list all the problems they could think of that evangelists and evangelism had. So after their hour of brainstorming, they came together and they created this list, which one of them termed the Modesto Manifesto, which I think is very remarkable, and I'll go through these points. First point, financial accountability. Avoid financial abuse, downplay offerings, and depend as much as possible from other donations. They would not try to make this a money-making scheme. They would try to get other sources of funding besides at their meetings. Two, moral integrity. He recognized the challenges of being apart from his wife. They pledged to avoid any situation that would have even the appearance of compromise or suspicion. Billy did not travel, meet, or eat alone with a woman other than his wife. Three, respect for the local church and pastors. They would avoid criticizing the local church. They would avoid poor attitudes. Instead, they would try to build up the local churches when they came in for meetings in a town. And then fourth, truth and publicity. They would not exaggerate successes. They would be honest in their publicity and reporting. So that was a very solid foundation for years of ministry. The team was George Beverly Shea. He was a gospel singer. He won a Grammy in his later years, Gospel Music Hall of Fame. He did radio, TV, many, many concerts, recorded around 70 albums of music, and he was by Billy's side for many of those years. Cliff Burrows led congregational singing, helped with all parts of the organization. He would often lead huge choirs of up to 1,000 people at these crusades. Grady Wilson was a fellow evangelist. He would sometimes fill in if Billy was too sick to preach. He was also a lifelong friend. And then T.W. Wilson was also a friend, travel companion, and assistant. Billy's kind of big push into the news, into people's vocabulary, was in the because of the Los Angeles crusade in 1949. He was doing a three-week crusade, and the crowds were pretty poor. Los Angeles was fairly dark at this point. However, a popular radio show host mentioned Billy Graham, and large crowds began attending. And he got several very well-known celebrities that made commitments and endorsed Billy Graham, and so that brought huge crowds out to this crusade. Headlines read, Fifth Sin Smashing Week and Revival at the Canvas Cathedral. This crusade stretched from 3 weeks all the way out to 8 weeks. And crowds, huge crowds. Billy Graham was now 30, and he was a well-known name across the nation. Although this sounds slightly glamorized, Billy Graham was preaching solid, convicting messages. Billy Graham preached that wickedness and sin, that they had a choice between wickedness and sin or revival and renewal. Approximately 350,000 people attended these gatherings, which was phenomenal in those days. Following these meetings, many clergy, theologians, ministers, and press scrutinized his sermons and his approach. In an article by Andrew Finston, he writes, "If the 1949 campaign marked the beginning of a shift in his preaching tone, the end came a decade later. Billy's approach had changed. His message focused on the cross and its dual revelation of the sins of man, but also the unwavering love of God. I stress a great deal the love of God from the cross, saying to the whole world, I love you and I will forgive you. So we note that Billy didn't change his preaching on repentance. He stressed this throughout his ministry. He approached the gospel as the really good news to those lost and confused and frustrated about purpose and meaning in life. He became more practical. Initially, he was kind of a hell and brimstone type of minister, and he became a little bit more relaxed during that first decade. Graham studied his audience and recognized that he ministered to a population, especially in America, beset by doubt, loneliness, and unhappiness during an era known as the Age of Anxiety. He focused more on the grace of God. The love of God became the central theme of his message. Graham spoke more often of sin as a condition of all humanity, as opposed to sin as one particular transgression or another. So I'll just kind of go over his ministry as it developed over the many years. Billy Graham continued to lead crusades from 1947 all the way to 2005. He founded the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association in 1950. It is still very active today. In 1954, he had a London crusade, which he received a lot of feedback for. The established church in London was pretty hesitant to have this evangelist from America come over and, you know, set things straight. So he had quite a bit of resistance. In England, a reporter criticized the Billy Graham team. When Jesus was on earth, he rode a lowly donkey. I cannot imagine Jesus arriving in England on a great ocean liner. One of Billy's companions fired back, Listen, man, if you can find me a donkey that can swim the Atlantic, I'll buy it on the spot. Pretty good response. During the London Crusade, Billy preached tirelessly to packed out auditoriums night after night. He preached for 88 nights. His physical health suffered, and he barely had enough strength sometimes to preach. He ended up preaching to over 2 million people during this crusade. He also hosted the radio show Hour of Decision, which went, he hosted it 1950 to 1954, but it went on for many, many more years. He began airing ministry on national television in 1951. He helped produce several evangelistic-themed movies. At one point, he was even asked by one of the producers, like, would you want to be an actor in one of your movies? And this is his response. I looked him straight in the eye, with the others listening, and told him that God had called me to preach the gospel and that I would never do anything else as long as I lived. He was a spiritual advisor to many U.S. presidents, from the 33rd Harry Truman to the 44th Barack Obama. He was especially close to Dwight D. Eisenhower, Lyndon B. Johnson, and Richard Nixon. He spent time with Dwight D. Eisenhower, especially towards the end of his life. He spent many, many hours with him, had many good conversations and prayers with him. Ronald Reagan mentioned that it was through Billy Graham that he found himself praying on a more daily basis. Gerald Ford, he epitomized absolute integrity from the public ministry. During Nixon's Watergate scandal, Billy Graham came to the White House. Before he left, he put his arms around the president and had prayer. Nixon knew he was a hated man. After prayer, tears were coming down Nixon's cheeks. In the last years of Nixon's presidency, Billy never got to see him. Billy later learned that Nixon had instructed his White House staff to not let Billy Graham near him. He didn't want him tarred with Watergate. He also helped start the presidential prayer breakfast, and he led at many of those. And that's a tradition that's still going today. He has been a major mediator between presidents in numerous conflicts, possibly helping bring an end to the Cold War. In 1977, he led a trip into communist-held Hungary, which opened a new phase of his ministry, eventually enabling him to conduct preaching crusades in virtually every country of the former Eastern Bloc, which would be the Iron Curtain. He went into the USSR and China and North Korea. Billy Graham, quote, "How marvelous it was to stand in a place like the Soviet Union and talk about the coming kingdom and to tell them that communism will not win. I told them capitalism wouldn't win either. It's the kingdom of God that's going to win." This is a reporter to Billy Graham. "Are you aware of the fact that in Moscow, in the Moscow Baptist Church, one-third of your audience was KGB agents?" Billy replies, "No, I was not aware of that at the time of my preaching in the Baptist Church, but I'm glad to hear it. I always wanted to preach to KGB agents. They also need Jesus Christ for their salvation." Gerald Ford. "There's no doubt that Billy Graham, on his many visits to Eastern Europe and to the Soviet Union, lighted or reignited the flames of religious belief and conviction. And that, in turn, had a political impact on what took place in these communist-dominated nations, and was helpful in bringing about the change from what it was many years ago. He often personally responded to national disasters, both providing for spiritual and physical needs there. He provided training for thousands of ministers. He would provide crusades for training ministers and evangelists. He fought racial segregation. He tore down ropes for segregated seating in a tent. When he preached, he would not allow the congregation to be segregated. It would have to be integrated. And in the 50s and 60s, that was pretty tense. That was something you wouldn't necessarily do. In 1957, he preached with Martin Luther King Jr. in New York City, and he considered him a very close friend. He received an invitation to preach in South Africa, but refused until he could preach to an open audience, openly rejecting apartheid there. He says, "Christianity is not a white man's religion, and don't let anyone ever tell you that. It belongs to all people. It belongs to the whole world." Further crusades went into Asia, Japan, North and South Korea, India, Iran, Australia, Africa, Central and South America. He even preached at the Miami Rock Festival in 1969. So he preached a bunch of hippies, people that were high, and he actually got a fairly good response at this rock festival. In 1973, he created the World Emergency Fund, which is created to help with emergencies and disaster needs throughout the world. His largest audience ever was in Seoul, Korea, and he had over 1 million people in attendance. He did many preaching services in New York, in Central Park, baseball arenas. He would preach in rain to soldiers in Vietnam, sweltering heat, bitter cold. He talks about it sleeting and raining while he's preaching, and nobody left. Everyone stayed there and listened to what he had to say. He had many close calls throughout the years. Throughout the book, there's incredible stories of God answering prayers. He was on the early end of aviation, so he had some pretty close calls in airplanes. He actually was in an airplane crash and survived that. He nearly got mauled by sharks in Australia. He had a large blood clot develop in one of his legs, and that could have been very devastating to his health. There's a lot of incredible stories of how God worked in his life. And you see how much he depended on prayer, hours spent in prayer, late in the night. Whenever something came up, first thing he did was pray. In 1993, Billy Graham starts The Cove, a Bible training and retreat center in Asheville, North Carolina. 2001, the Rapid Response Team was started, which allows pastors to travel to areas of disaster and tragedy. So fairly close to home, a handful of pastors on the Rapid Response Team responded to Kansas City last summer when those two deputies were shot. This is a quote from an article. "In the meantime, they've been talking and praying with people from all over the community, with many meaningful conversations taking place in and around the Rapid Response Team's mobile ministry center. The large black truck, which often accompanies chaplain teams when they deploy to tragedies, is set up only a few hundred yards from the courthouse where the shooting took place. The ministry has really opened up, and God has shown up, as He always does. The community is embracing our presence here, and people are seeing the Mobile Ministry Center as a place of refuge where they can come in and express their feelings and emotions freely. And that was from last summer. In 2007, the Billy Graham Library was founded and dedicated. According to his website, Graham preached to live audiences of 210 million people in more than 185 countries and territories. He met many world leaders and famous people, including Winston Churchill, Margaret Thatcher, Queen Elizabeth II, Boris Yeltsin, Mikhail Gorbachev, Bob Dole. He met many of the popes, Arnold Palmer, Walt Disney, Bob Hope, Muhammad Ali, Jeff Gordon, Johnny Cash, and so many more. According to his staff, more than 3.2 million people have responded to the invitation at Billy Graham's Crusades to accept Jesus Christ as their personal Savior. As of 2008, Graham's estimated lifetime audience, including radio and television broadcasts, topped 2.2 billion. He wrote over 30 books throughout his lifetime. Many were on the bestseller list. Several of the most popular were Peace with God, Just as I Am, and Where I Am, Heaven, Eternity, and Our Life Beyond. He co-founded Christianity Today and founded The Decision magazine. Because of his crusades, Billy Graham preached the gospel to more people in person than anyone else. Graham was on Gallup's list of most admired men and women 61 times, more than any other person in history. He won many, many awards and received a lot of honor and recognition. And this is his response: "I'm just a spectator watching what God is doing." So what kind of preacher was Billy Graham? I'll give a few opinions from people that knew him well. Craig Larson: "Watching Graham stand and deliver, it's hard not to notice externals. He certainly enjoyed a commanding presence. Tall and straight as an arrow, he had long arms that sliced the air constantly, eyes as arresting as any general at the head of a charge or any prophet come down from the mountain. He had thick hair, a high forehead, and a superhero jaw." Nancy Gibbs from Times wrote this: "One description I love is the writer who, looking at Billy Graham's long arms and long legs, said it looked as though God had designed him to be seen from a distance." This figure could fill a stadium with 50,000 or 100,000 people night after night after night. We imagined this huge public personality. What was most surprising to us the first day we went to his home was how completely disarming he was. We were struck by his humility, his gentleness, the quiet, confident grace. He seemed perhaps the most unguarded man I've ever interviewed. He was not spinning, not looking to airbrush his history. The thing he was most worried about was that he might make a mistake or forget to give someone credit for something they deserve. Graham had a great gift for keeping things simple. He was a very smart, thoughtful man. He never felt like he needed or wanted to stray from the core gospel message of Christ's saving grace. He made it possible for people to let down their guard. He created a safe place where you could let go of your pride, let go of your self-consciousness, let go of everything, and just focus on what he was saying. He created that one-on-one, and he created it one on 100,000. Rick Warren, quote, "The greatest influence the man had on me came not from what he taught, but simply from who he was. Whenever anybody says, 'Who's going to replace Graham?' the answer is that he's irreplaceable. There will never be another Billy Graham." So I'd like to read a little bit from a sermon by Billy Graham to give you a little bit of an idea of what a sermon might have sounded like. "One of the pet words of this age is tolerance. It is a good word, but we have tried to stretch it out over too great an area of life. We have applied it too often where it does not belong. The word tolerant means liberal, broad-minded, willing to put up with beliefs opposed to one's convictions, and the allowance of something not wholly approved. Tolerance, in one sense, implies the compromise of one's convictions, a yielding of ground upon important issues. Hence, over-tolerance in moral issues has made us soft, flabby, and devoid of convictions. We have become tolerant about divorce. We have become tolerant about the use of alcohol. We have become tolerant about delinquency. We have become tolerant about wickedness in high places. We have become tolerant about immorality. We have become intolerant. We have become tolerant about crime, and we have become tolerant about godlessness. We have become tolerant of unbelief. In a book recently published on what prominent people believe, 60 out of 100 did not even mention God, and only 11 out of 100 mentioned Jesus. We have become sapped of conviction, drained of our beliefs, and bereft of our faith. The sciences, however, call for narrow-mindedness. There is no room for broad-mindedness in the laboratory. Water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level. It never does at 100 degrees nor 189 degrees, but always 212. Water freezes at 32 degrees, not at 23 or 31. Take mathematics. The sum of 2 plus 2 is 4, not 3.5. That seems very narrow, but arithmetic is not broad. Neither is geometry. It says that a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. That seems very dogmatic and narrow, but geometry is intolerant. If you should ask a man the direction to New York City, and he said, "Oh, just take any road you wish. They all lead there," you would question either his sanity or his truthfulness. Somehow, we have gotten into our minds that all roads lead to heaven. You hear people say, "Do your best, be honest, and be sincere. You will make it to heaven all right." But Jesus Christ, who journeyed from heaven to earth and back to heaven again, who knew the way better than any man who ever lived, said, "Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it. Because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it." So that was an excerpt from one of his sermons. Billy Graham preached simple. There are 4 things that are very important to help you as a new believer. First, read the Bible. It's God's word, written to you. Second, pray. Take everything to God in prayer because he loves you and you are now his child. Talk to God like you would to your best friend. Third, witness for Christ. Tell someone about your decision for Christ, then witness by your smile and by your love and your concern for others. And fourth, get into a church where Christ is proclaimed and where you can serve him. Billy depended much on his wife, Ruth, for his ministry. Like I said before, without Ruth, there might not be a Billy Graham. There was 5 children born to Billy and Ruth. Billy was often away from home for months at a time, sometimes up to 7 months during his crusades. So she was left at home to raise the children. And that she took that as her ministry. The children have remarked that they never heard their mother complain about Billy or say anything negative about him. And that's one thing they did as a couple, is they did not speak negatively about the other person in front of the children. And the children said they rarely, if ever, saw their parents argue. From their son, Franklin Graham, who was quite rebellious as a younger man, but is now evangelist, he says, "I'll never forget the first time my mother heard me preach. Standing at the podium and seeing her in the shadows, I realized just how much that moment represented an answer to her faithful prayers. To follow in my father's footsteps, I had to go through my mother's knee prints. Even in my rebellious years, I never doubted that Mama loved me unconditionally. I knew she prayed for me earnestly." "She knew when to lecture me, when to punish me, and when to hug me. She once said, 'Franklin's guardian angel has always had to work overtime.' As my father was busy in his worldwide ministry, my mother was equally busy in her version of home missions, raising our family in an atmosphere that was wholesome, fun, and God-fearing. She gave up her dream of becoming a missionary to Tibet because she realized that God was calling her to serve him at home. She taught us to memorize scriptures, to think for ourselves, and to care for others. No one could look at her life and doubt that she chose God's will for her life. Mama was fearless and tough. She wasn't scared of chasing a rattlesnake, jumping on a motorcycle, climbing on a roof, or confronting a protester. Three passions defined my mother's life. First, she loved the Lord with every ounce of her being. For Mama, that was as much a lifestyle as it was a commandment. When God called her to be a wife and a homemaker rather than being a missionary, she committed it to prayer and she faithfully followed where he led. Secondly, she loved God's word. Mama believed the Bible, lived the Bible, and taught the Bible. How thankful I am today that she made us children memorize scripture, even if I didn't appreciate it as a boy. A quote from Ruth: "The Bible stayed open in my kitchen all day. Whenever there was a spare minute, I grabbed that minute and spent it with the Bible. More likely than not, the book was open to Proverbs. If I had a problem, I almost always got help there. Proverbs has more practical child help in it than 10 books on child psychology." Third, she loved God's people, especially those who needed a helping hand, a guiding touch, or a loving hug. She delighted in doing things that you never heard about: cooking for a sick neighbor, teaching Sunday school, and visiting the local jail. What lessons can we learn from the life of Billy Graham? His passion for evangelism. A quote from him: "I consider the call to the ministry the highest and most marvelous calling in the world, because it's an eternal calling, and I wouldn't trade places with any president or king." On TV, Billy stated, "My purpose is to win as many people to him as I can, because he ordered us to." One important aspect of Graham's teaching was his continuous return to the good news of Christ crucified. Though this habit garnered constant criticism, he refused to be dislodged from the essentials. A little story and lesson from Rick Warren. "I learned from Graham to never lose your single focus. His focus was always on bringing people to Christ. I remember Graham received the Congressional Gold Medal in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol in 1996. There were about 400 chairs packed with VIPs. President Clinton and leaders of the House and Senate addressed the crowd, honoring Graham's life and his achievements. What do you think Graham did when it came time for him to get up to speak? He spent maybe 3 minutes acknowledging the honor and how little he deserved it. Then he said, 'Let me tell you about Jesus.' Even though the entire event was about him, he turned the meeting toward his lifetime central focus of Jesus." A close friend to the Grahams relates this story: "I was touched to be invited to spend Christmas with the family in Montreat. I cherish two vivid memories of that visit. The first was family prayers each day. I saw the world-famous evangelist reading the scriptures and praying with Ruth and their children. Secondly, we all carried Christmas parcels to a settlement of poor hillbilly families on a nearby mountain. In both cases, Graham, the mass evangelist, was sharing the gospel with those closest to him. Crusades would stretch out for weeks and even months. Billy would preach each night, often preparing the sermon that day. He would stay up late into the night working with those who came forward at the invitation. The morning would be filled with press engagements and meetings. He always found time for devotions and for prayer. Still, the work was physically and emotionally exhausting. He would sometimes lose 20 to 30 pounds per crusade. He would come out of them just completely exhausted. Each night, he would leave the stage covered in sweat, so weak he could barely take off his clothes. From his book, "My exhaustion was caused not just by the intensive schedule. A doctor who was also an evangelist once told me, the hardest work a person can do is preach an evangelistic sermon. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. What I do know is that the evangelistic preaching is physically and emotionally draining. One reason it is so draining for me is that I'm constantly driving for commitment. Another reason is that speaking of matters with eternal consequences is a great responsibility for me. I'm always afraid I won't make the message clear, or I will say something that is misleading. From the moment I stand up to speak to a crowd, I am thinking about that person whose life is being crushed by heartache, or alcohol, or family problems, and I want to make the hope of the gospel as clear as possible as I can to them. Sometimes I pick out someone in the audience who seems to be especially burdened, and I speak directly to that person. Preaching always involves a spiritual battle with the forces of evil. I am deeply conscious that I am absolutely helpless and that only the Holy Spirit can penetrate the minds and hearts of those who are without Christ. You can also learn about his use of a strong team. Billy Graham used others to help him and his ministry. Everybody on the team brought strength to the table. They knew their weaknesses, and they reinforced each other. They allowed each one to play their role. The core team worked together for around 50 years. They spent hours in prayer and meaningful discussion about their ministry. Integrity. John Stott, a fellow evangelist, says this: if I had to choose one word with which to characterize Billy Graham, it would be integrity. He was all of a piece. There was no dichotomy between what he said and what he was. He practiced what he preached. A journalist regarding his interaction with presidents said, America got lucky with Billy, given how much power he had. He had an agenda when he walked into that Oval Office. It wasn't a political one, it was a spiritual one. Finance. When Billy Graham came to London, a considerable group of church leaders were wondering whether to invite him to preach there. They were critical, but he had anticipated their questions. He was able to say he received a fixed salary, less than most salaries paid to senior pastors of large churches, and he received no love offerings. As for crusade finances, they were published in the press during each crusade. Billy had a net worth of about $25 million when he died. However, he lived a fairly modest life and continued to receive a handsome but reasonable salary for his life. Humility. As noted before, we see Billy's incredible humility. He always acknowledged others and God. This is a quote from Billy. All that I have been able to do, I owe to Jesus Christ. When you honor me, you are really honoring him. Any honors I have received, I accept with a sense of inadequacy and humility, and I will reserve the right to hand all these someday to Christ when I see him face to face. And that was upon receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Few Christian leaders have been granted an audience with successive American presidents, with Queen Elizabeth II, with Winston Churchill, with popes, celebrities, and with many other national leaders. Lesser mortals might have been tempted to use these opportunities to boost their own ego, but Graham used them as opportunities to spread the gospel. Influence. He did much to encourage those around him. He mentored, and he put on crusades for younger evangelists. Although Billy's life may seem almost perfect, I'd like to point out a few mistakes, and some of these he acknowledges, and a few viewpoints that may differ from ours. In the early 70s, Graham was quite close to President Nixon. Billy trusted him as a friend, and Nixon had a lot of appreciation for Billy and for his advice. Although he remained firmly planted in his role as minister for the majority of his career, he probably got too close to Nixon. Leaked tapes record Graham and Nixon sharing disparaging comments about the Jews. Graham later was shocked and embarrassed by these comments. Those closest to him agreed that those comments were not true to who Billy Graham was. He apologized for those remarks. He does not regret his incredible opportunity to share the gospel and encourage those in high political power. Also, his stance on non-resistance and the church and state would be different than ours. At one point, he had wanted to join the military as a chaplain for the military. He did not pass his physical. Final years of Billy Graham's life. He retired in 2005. He continued to be active in the ministry. He wrote a lot more after his retirement. His last crusade was in New York, 200-some thousand in attendance. His wife, Ruth, passed away in 2007. Billy spent a lot more time writing and thinking over his life in the last number of years. Conversation between Ruth and Billy. Ruth, it hasn't been all that hard sticking beside him. It has been nothing but pure joy. Most of the time it's been pure joy. I say 98% of the time. Billy, there's that 2% she's not sure about. I'll try to find out what that is. Ruth, those 2% make it interesting. Graham passed away February 21, 2018. He was aged 99. He died from natural causes. He did have Parkinson's. Several final thoughts from Graham. Although I have much to be grateful for as I look over my life, I also have many regrets. I have failed many times and would do many things differently. For one thing, I would speak less and study more, and I would spend more time with my family. Every day I was absent from my family was a day gone forever. I would also spend more time in spiritual nurture, seeking to grow closer to God so I could become more like Christ. I would spend more time in prayer, not just for myself, but for others. I would spend more time studying the Bible and meditating on its truths, not only for sermon preparation, but to apply its message to my life. I would give more attention to fellowship with other Christians who could teach me and encourage me and even rebuke me when necessary. If I had it to do over again, I would also avoid any semblance of involvement in partisan politics. When a president of the United States, for example, wept in my presence, or knelt with me to pray, or privately unburdened his concern about his family, I was not thinking about his political philosophy or his personality, but about his need for God's help. About one thing, I have absolutely no regrets, and that is my commitment many years ago to accept God's calling to serve him as an evangelist of the gospel of Christ. Once asked what he loved most about his years in ministry, Graham replied without hesitation, "It has been my fellowship with Jesus, to sense his presence, to glean his wisdom, to have him guide and direct me. That has been my greatest joy." Another quote, "My one purpose in life is to help people find a personal relationship with God, which I believe comes through knowing Christ." Someday you will hear that Billy Graham has died. Don't believe a word of it. I shall be more alive then than I am now. I will have just changed my address. I will have gone into the presence of God. So I'd like to read, on a more humorous note, a story from this book. Like I said, he had many close calls and many interesting trips, traveling all over the globe in the early days of aviation. So this is one of those stories that is pretty interesting. So I think in 1949. Uncle Tom Graham died in June 1949. I was in Kansas City with Bev Shea and Al Metzner preparing for a Youth for Christ rally to be held on June 11th. When I learned that Uncle Tom had died, I asked Grady to begin the Altoona meetings for me. The funeral was to be the day after the rally, on Sunday, so we would have to fly out in order to make it on time. Tahlequah, Oklahoma was well off the beaten path. I asked Al to see if he could get us a private plane. The best he could do was a single-engine Stinson Reliant. Early Sunday morning, Bev and I set out. When we arrived at the airport, we had a plane, but no one to fly it. The best we could do was a student pilot. After we took off, I asked the young man how long the trip would take. "Maybe an hour," he answered. maybe an hour and a half. We hadn't been airborne all that long when the young pilot made a casual observation. I don't know if we have any fuel. The gauge isn't working. He, Bev, and I began to look for a place to land. Fortunately, we spotted a small runway in the middle of nowhere. The young man brought the plane down ably enough, but when we got out, there was nobody around. It's Sunday, said Bev. Everybody must be in church. The young man went over to a parked car, siphoned the gas right out of its tank, and transferred the fuel to our airplane in one smooth sweep. I just stood there watching. Apparently, he had done this sort of thing before. Bev and the pilot were clamoring for me to get on board and to get out of there. I reached into my pocket, pulled out some bills, and ran to stick them under the car's windshield wiper. Then, without looking back, I ran for the plane, hoping that what I had left would be enough to cover the gas and the inconvenience. Airborne again, I noticed that the engine seemed to be asthmatic, wheezing when it should be whirring. I leaned forward and asked the pilot a simple question. Is car gasoline good for a plane engine? It can't hurt, came the reply. It can't hurt, repeated Bev with a nod. We soon flew into a rainstorm. To cover my anxiety, I talked to the pilot again. What do you do for a living? I asked him. I lay carpet. He lays carpet, repeated Bev with another doubtful nod. The worse the storm became, the more I talked. By the way, how long have you been flying? Well, I've been working at it on and off for 6 months, he said proudly. I suppose you have your pilot's license. Oh, yes, sir, I have my pilot's license, he assured me. And you have your license to carry passengers? Well, no, sir, I don't have that yet, he admitted. Don't have that yet, repeated Bev, nodding in my direction. Have you ever flown this plane before? I asked, suspecting the answer. Not this plane, he said. Not this plane, repeated Bev, this time shaking his head. Bev and I would have jumped if only we could have found the chutes. We landed two more times, each time to pick up more fuel. Real plane fuel, not gasoline. But we seemed to be getting no nearer to Tahlequah. Bev and I resigned ourselves to the inevitable. We were never going to get to this funeral. At the same time, we decided we were not going to board the plane again. We walked down the road toward what we hoped was a village or a town. Our prayers were quickly answered. A man drove up in an ancient Chevy. I run this little airport, he said. When I heard the plane, I decided to come back here to find out what was wrong. He drove us back to the airport, filled the plane's tank, and gave the pilot directions. Bev and I decided to try it again after all. Our hopes rose when we spotted a runway that seemed to match the description given by our airport rescuer. The pilot buzzed the cattle off the strip and then made his descent onto the grass, which was apparently higher than the pilot figured. We jolted down and rolled to a quick stop. I got out and walked around the plane. The propeller and both the wheels were choked with thick clumps of green strands. As I looked at this problem, a word of warning was shouted from the plane. I turned around and saw a heifer with horns charging right at me. I made it over the barbed wire fence just in time, but not without a couple of scratches. When I turned around again, I noticed some farm folks who had been watching our antics in the field. I knew the answer was no, but I had to ask the question anyways. Is this the airport for Tahlequah? No, sir, it's over on the other side of town, the man said. It seems there were two airports in Tahlequah. Since we were expected at the real airport and the bystanders could offer us no ground transportation, we decided to fly across town. I went back over the fence to the field and explained the situation. After we'd cut away as much of the grass as we could from the wheels and propeller, the pilot was able to turn the plane around and take off. Not many minutes later, we saw the paved runway of the other airport and noticed some cars screeching to a stop. They had heard our plane and had come to pick us up. As they drove us to the church, they told us the funeral service had already started. The minister received us with great excitement, and there was my uncle lying in the front with the casket open. Bev went to the piano where he sat down and readied himself to play. I sat down where the minister indicated I should, opened my Bible, and got ready to speak. They had the funeral service. And then back to the airport, Bev and I made a deal. If the prop did not start on the first catch, we were going to take the train. It caught, though, and we flew back with barely a wheeze to Kansas City, We even had a beautiful sunset. It certainly felt good to get on a full-size airliner, a DC-4 as I recall, to fly to Altoona. So that was one of his adventures. Well, thank you very much for your attention, and I hope this has been informative and inspirational for you. I know studying it has been for me, so I'll turn the time over to Dwight.